Welcome to Chapter and Verse. If this is the first time you've seen this program, welcome. We're glad you're here with us. If you've watched our previous series, Messianic Apologetics, or our Shabbat discussion, welcome back. In this new series, we will be discussing the topic, Are Torah and Yeshua Synonymous Terms? There is a mentality that has slowly taken over our walk of faith. The concept that this mentality is based upon seems, on the surface, to be spot on. It sounds extremely spiritually sound, and it appears to fit perfectly within our theological framework. But in reality, this type of thinking does us a huge disservice. That is because the logical conclusion to this type of ideology ends up leading us down a path that is insidious and filled with pitfalls that will cause us to stumble and eventually to deny Yeshua. This is exactly why we chose to address this topic here on Chapter and Verse. What initially sounds good to us ends up becoming our very undoing. Chances are you've heard this ideology expressed in numerous forms, and when you hear me say it, your initial reaction will likely be to issue a hearty amen and agree with the sentiment. I'm here to caution you, however, that this mentality is to be rejected. In the next several episodes, we will attempt to show you why this doctrine is unhealthy. We hope and pray that when you hear this topic of discussion, that you will not immediately reject our position, but that you will approach this topic with an open mind and at least hear us out. In his recording of the travels of Barnabas and Paul in the book of Acts, Luke describes a group of believers in the city of Berea as an example for us all. Luke described these believers in Berea with the following description in Acts chapter 17, verse 11. Now these were more noble-minded than those in Thessalonica, for they received the word with great eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see whether these things were so. Let that be our example and our anthem. Let's approach this topic, and every topic, by receiving the word with great eagerness and examining the scriptures in order to establish truth. In this series, we will be presenting information from both the Bible as well as some other sources, such as the Aramaic Targums, in order to reveal why the ideology we will be looking at is so faulty. It is important for us to understand that the books of the Bible were not written in a vacuum, and that sometimes external sources can provide key details that reveal to us how we should understand some of the things that were written in Scripture. In order to be theologically consistent and accurate, it is essential to examine the language of the original documents. Without digging into the meaning and context of words, those words lack any real authority or conviction to cement our beliefs. So it's very important to employ textual and linguistic discipline when discussing topics such as the role and function of Messiah. Here in the first two episodes of this series, I will be giving an overview of this topic and going through many of the aspects of how this ideology formed and how it can potentially affect our approach to the scriptures. Then, in episodes 3 and 4, we will have two very special guests on the show with whom we will be discussing this topic and its far-reaching effects. I am very excited to speak with these men and to introduce this audience to them. They are men I highly respect, and I believe they will offer some unique insights to assist us in strengthening our faith. I believe that they will offer some very insightful commentary on this topic. Then, finally, in episode 5, I will come back and go over and summarize all the key points, as well as to potentially expand upon some that may have been overlooked. So, to get this discussion started, let's talk about something that has been happening more and more frequently within the Messianic Judaism, Hebrew roots, Torah observant, whatever we call it, walk of faith. Perhaps you're familiar with the phrase, Yeshua is the Torah made flesh. Maybe you've seen the meme that has gone around that attempts to equate Yeshua to the Torah. We will be addressing this meme in episode 2. But first, let's lay a little groundwork. Much of the sentiment that is behind this doctrine comes from a misunderstanding of the words of the Apostle John in his gospel account. Most of us are very familiar with the opening statement John makes. John chapter 1, verses 1 through 3 says, In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with Elohim, and the Word was Elohim. He was in the beginning with Elohim. All things came into being through him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. These three verses are then combined with verse 14, which says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth." Indeed, all those things are true, and they are all a reflection of the amazing story of how Yeshua set aside his divine nature in order to dwell among us. He did this so that he could identify with our flesh, with its weaknesses and with its tendencies, so that he could then be our high priest and to take all those things upon himself so that we might be set free in him. In our modern vernacular, we often refer to the Bible as the Word. While this mentality can be supported through a holistic approach to be a reference to all the instruction, all the testimony, and the records that are written down for our benefit, there's not a single verse anywhere in Scripture that refers to a sefer or a book or even a compilation of books, such as the Bible is, as being referred to with the title the Word. It is essential that we understand this concept first and foremost. I've used the phrase the Word to refer to Scripture in the past, and I will continue to do so in the future. But we must understand that the modern way that we use this phrase, the Word, is not the same way that John used this phrase. In order to understand what John meant in the opening chapter of his gospel account, we need to first examine the references and influences John would have been familiar with. One of these influences would have been the Aramaic Targums. What are the Aramaic Targums, and why would they have influenced the Apostle John? The Aramaic Targums are a translation of the Tanakh, written a few centuries before Yeshua took on flesh at his incarnation. I bring up these Targums because they were in use in the first century. Yeshua's disciples would have very likely have been familiar with them. Why would they have been familiar with these works? We will discover the answer to that question over the next few minutes. In order to keep things in proper perspective here, we need to be mindful that the disciples Yeshua selected were, predominantly, unlearned men. They were not men who had studied at the feet of the Jewish spiritual leaders. They were, for the most part, tradesmen. They were literate, but they had probably achieved only a maximum level of education, equivalent to our modern high school education. In other words, these guys were not college graduates. In fact, most of them had probably only attained an educational level similar to our current junior high level. Most of them were fishermen. As fishermen, it's highly likely that they were called upon by their families fairly early in life to put aside their educations so that they could help provide for their household. Further, one of the most important things to consider within the context of this conversation, the language they would have spoken on a daily basis most likely would have been Aramaic, not Hebrew. They for sure would have been exposed to Hebrew in the synagogue, and there's a good chance they would have known at least some Hebrew, but they would have primarily and predominantly spoken Aramaic in the first century, not Hebrew. Most of us are under the perception that Yeshua and his disciples all walked around speaking Hebrew, but that simply doesn't match the historical or cultural context of the time and the numerous supporting evidences that we have in the Gospels that gives us examples in Aramaic. What do I mean by that? Well, there are numerous examples in the Gospels that tell us about the language of the day. Of course, our Gospel accounts that we have are all written in Greek. Did the original authors pen them in the Greek language? I'm not entirely sure, but I really don't think so. Of course, there has been much debate about this over the years. I can affirm that at least the works of Luke, which include the Gospel of Luke, the Book of Acts, and all the books ascribed to Paul, as well as the book of Hebrews, were for sure written in Greek. I can say this because Luke is identified in Colossians 4:14 as being an iatros, that's the Greek word for physician. This and other clues have led most Bible scholars to conclude that Luke had Greek lineage. If this assumption is accurate, it helps us to understand why Luke could have originally recorded these books of the Bible in the Greek language. As far as the book of Hebrews go, the unidentified author of the book of Hebrews uses the Greek Septuagint version of the Tanakh exclusively as his source text, which is evident from several references that he makes in that letter that come directly from the Septuagint version of the Old Testament. Additionally, this author uses some phrases that are specifically indicative of formal Greek training, not simply someone who is vaguely familiar with the Greek language. As far as the other books, I think it unlikely that Peter and John, at a minimum, originally penned their works in Greek. I personally find it hard to believe that two fishermen, who were seen as being uneducated and untrained, would be capable of writing lengthy documents in Greek. That said, we do not have any historical documents that can either confirm or deny that suspicion. All we have are the Greek documents. That's all there is to draw from at this point. Due to that fact, we have to search carefully for the clues. But if we look, they're there. If we could only diligently search for them. Examples. We see passages such as in John chapter 5, verse 2, John chapter 19, verse 13, verse 17, and verse 20. John chapter 20, verse 16. And we can also see in Acts chapter 21, verse 40, chapter 22, verse 2, and 26, verse 14. You have to look in the ESV or the CSB versions to see this. But these two versions are the most recent, most accurate versions to be produced in our lifetimes. I personally use the NASB, the New American Standard Version, and I have for years, but I'm currently in the process of transitioning to the ESV, the English Standard Version, for reasons like this. In all those verses I just named off, my NASB version reads such and such, which is called, in Hebrew, this, or something akin to that. Modern scholarship, however, has revealed that Hebrew was not the common language of the first century. Aramaic was, as we've discussed. Thus, the newer versions, which reflect this fact, render these same verses as such and such, which is called in Aramaic, whatever the word is. For example, in John chapter 19, verse 13, it refers to a place that Pilate sat, called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbata. Now, if you look up this word in Gabbata in Hebrew, there's no real Hebrew explanation for that word. The closest meaning it would have in Hebrew would be the word back, as in the back of something. But in Aramaic, it makes a whole lot more sense because it means an elevated place or a raised platform, which is exactly what someone in Pilate's position would have seated himself in. It was, after all, as it refers to in that verse, the judgment seat. So, what is Aramaic, and why is this an important fact? Why are we following this line of logic? Well, Aramaic and Hebrew are very close cousin languages. One might suggest that one developed out of the other. At the time of the first century, and even long before that time, Aramaic was the universal language that was in use. Much like English today is the international language of commerce, Aramaic served in that function in the Middle East for centuries. To explain this in a way that's a little more easily understandable, let's go back to Abraham. When he was living in Ur of the Chaldees, which is southern present-day Iraq, what language would he and his family have spoken? Hebrew? If they spoke Hebrew, who would have understood them there? When he journeyed with his family up to the land of Aram, which is where the word Aramaic comes from, what language would he have spoken there? When Avram then traveled to the land of Canaan, present-day Israel, and he lived among the Canaanites who lived there, what language did he speak with them? Hebrew? Did they know Hebrew? When he traveled down to Egypt, what language did he speak there? How about when he negotiated with the sons of Chet, who were identified as Hittites? What language did he speak with them when he bought the cave of Machpelah in order to bury his wife Sarah? Think about it. Who was the first person to speak Hebrew? Was it Avraham? Was it his son Yitzhak? Was it his son Yaakov? Was it his sons, the 12, that all died in the land of Egypt? Was it their kids, the children of Israel who left Egypt and wandered in the wilderness for 40 years? Now, I'm not going to get into the claim that it came from Eber, Shem's great-grandson, that has a dozen holes in its logic. But the point of this is that Aramaic, the language that was dominant in what is now known as Syria, Lebanon, and southern Turkey, was the English, so to speak, of the Middle East. It was the language of commerce. Thus, virtually everyone in the land of Canaan and its surrounding areas would have spoken Aramaic. This is how Avram was able to communicate with such a diverse group of people from differing countries. By the days of the first century, we have a world where Greek became the dominant language of commerce, because of the influence of the Greek Empire. prior to the Roman occupation, of course, but Aramaic remained the common language among the residents. Thus, it's most likely that Aramaic was the language that the disciples spoke. In my personal view, which is supported by many scholars on this topic, Hebrew would have developed out of Aramaic. Hebrew and Aramaic, as I mentioned, are very closely related. You could kind of think of it this way. Aramaic is like what you would hear spoken in the northeast part of the United States. Hebrew would be more like what you would hear in the southern part of the United States. Now, someone from Boston can communicate with someone from Louisiana, but if you were to listen to the two of them, you might almost believe that they were speaking two different languages. In that example, Akkadian would have been like the language that is spoken in England. It's the language from which both Aramaic and Hebrew came. But I digress. The point of this is to say that the most likely language that was used by everyday common folk in the first century in Israel would have been Aramaic. We can see this from several examples. As mentioned previously, the ESV renders John chapter 5, verse 2 in this way. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. We also see the CSB rendering Acts chapter 21, verse 40, saying that Paul addressed the crowd in Aramaic. This occurs several times, including in Acts chapter 26, verse 14, where Paul is recalling his Damascus Road experience, and he says Yeshua spoke to him in Aramaic. This is also why we see in Mark's gospel account that when Yeshua is upon the cross in Mark chapter 15, 34, that it says, at the ninth hour, Yeshua cried out with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is translated, my El, my God, my El, why have you forsaken me? This phrase Yeshua cried out in was Aramaic, not Hebrew. In fact, it is most likely Aramaic that he spoke on a regular basis. Why is all of this so important? Because if Aramaic truly was the common language of the day in the first century, if Yeshua most likely spoke Aramaic most of the time, rather than Hebrew, then the same would have been true of the disciples. As mentioned, Aramaic is a very close cousin to Hebrew, so they sound very similar. I bring this up because this gives us a key contextual starting point for what we are about to cover. You see, if we're to get to the heart of what the Apostle John was saying at the beginning of his gospel, we first have to identify the language that he spoke. This helps to highlight a key element of something that is crucial for us to understand what it was that he was communicating. You see, if John spoke in Aramaic, and he wrote in Aramaic, then we have to consider the sources that he may have been familiar with and may even have referenced. What I'm getting at here is that I believe there is a very strong case to be made that the Apostle John, having been a native Aramaic speaker, would have been very familiar with a collection of books we refer to as the Aramaic Targums. Where did these Targums come from? Well, after the return from Babylon and Persian exile, Hebrew began to be only spoken in the synagogues, while Aramaic became much more widespread. In fact, we see this from Nehemiah chapter 8, verse 8. It says there, they read out of the book of the Torah of Elohim, translating and giving the meaning so that the people could understand what was read. They were reading the Hebrew, but they would have been translating from the biblical Hebrew into the spoken Aramaic. Around the same time, new Aramaic translations of the scriptures began to be composed so that everyone could understand. This is where the Aramaic Targums come into existence. The word Targum in Aramaic simply means translation. So the Aramaic Targums were simply the Aramaic translation of the Hebrew Tanakh. These Targums, because they were written in the language used by all the common people dwelling within the land of Israel, would have been probably the main text most of them would have used in order to read and understand the Tanakh. So now that we've determined that it was highly likely that John and the other disciples would have spoken Aramaic, and that Yeshua spoke Aramaic, and that the Bibles that they would have likely studied from would have likely been Aramaic via the Targums, we can now begin to lay the groundwork for John's point of reference when he penned the first chapter of his gospel account. As we discussed at length in our previous series on Messianic apologetics, in episode 8, replete within the Targums is the term memra. This word, memra, is the Aramaic word for word. It is surmised that the authors of the Targums inserted the word memra when they encountered potential issues with how the text reads. For example, in occasions where Adonai appears to be dealing with himself in a uniplural sense, such as in Exodus chapter 17, verse 16, or where there seem to be anthropomorphic references to Elohim, such as in Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 8, Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 11, among many other examples. Again, we discussed at length in episode 8 of Messianic Apologetics the term anthropomorphisms, as well as the context of why this phrase memra appears so many times within the Targums. So please watch that episode if you have any questions about this topic. But anytime these types of anthropomorphisms or other hard-to-explain passages occur, in the Aramaic Targums, the word memra was inserted into the text in order to attempt to get around these seeming contradictions. It was used in verses where Adonai appeared to be doing something that created a potential mental conundrum for the reader due to its anthropomorphic or uniplural nature. For instance, in the Targum Yonatan, Jonathan, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, it replaces the word Elohim, and instead it says, "And the word and the memra of Adonai created man in his likeness. In the likeness of Adonai, Adonai created. Male and female, he created them." Then there's this one from the Targum Onkelos in Genesis chapter 9, verse 7, where it says, "And Adonai said to Noach, this is the token of the covenant which I have established between my word, my memra, and between all flesh that is upon the earth." Another example from the Targum Onkelos, this time 6 chapters later, in Genesis chapter 15, verse 6. It says there, "And he," referring to Avram, "believed in the word, the memra of Adonai, and he reckoned it to him unto justification." And then we have from the Jerusalem Targum in Genesis chapter 16, verse 13, "And Hagar praised and prayed in the name of the memra, the word of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, who had revealed himself to her." Then from the Targum Onkelos in Genesis chapter 17, verse 7, "And I will establish my covenant between my word, my memra, and between you." And then from the Jerusalem Targum on Genesis chapter 22, verse 14, where it says, "And Avraham prayed in the name of the word, the memra of Adonai." And then from the Targum Onkelos in Genesis chapter 28, verses 20 and 21, "And Yaakov vowed a vow, saying, if the memra of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh will be my support and will keep me in the way that I go and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the memra of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh be my Elohim." And from the Jerusalem Targum, in Exodus chapter 3, verse 14, "And the memra of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh said to Moshe, I am he who said unto the world, be, and it was, and who in the future will say to it, be, and it shall be. And he said, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you." Other references, Exodus chapter 9, verses 20 and 21, the Targums say there, "Those among Pharaoh's officials who feared the memra of Adonai made their servants and livestock flee to shelters. But those who didn't take to heart Adonai's memra left their servants and livestock in the field." Now, as I read that, you should have seen the English from the NASB version on your screen. Did you see where it says memra in the Targums? Our English versions translate it as the word, word. Further, in Exodus chapter 31, verse 13, the Targums read, "Tell the Israelites, you must observe my Sabbaths, for it is a sign between the memra and you throughout your generations, so that you will know that I am Adonai who consecrates you." Then we see in Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 3, where it says, "Know therefore today that it is the memra of Adonai your Elohim who is crossing over before you as a consuming fire." Finally, there's this from the 1901 Jewish Encyclopedia in regard to this concept of this memra. It says, "Memra, the word, in the sense of the creative or directive word or speech of God manifesting his power in the world of matter or mind, a term used especially in the Targum as a substitute for the Lord when an anthropomorphic expression is to be avoided." Our apologies for inundating you with a plethora of references from the Aramaic Targums where this word the memra appears. But it was important to establish that fact, and reading from the description of the Jewish Encyclopedia, which encapsulates exactly what the function of the memra serves within those Aramaic Targums. As we will see in a few moments, we should be viewing the opening words from John's gospel account within light of this knowledge. This memra was used to express Adonai's creative power, such as when he spoke things into being in the creation account. This then, of course, would tie directly into what John said in John chapter 1, verse 3. All things came into being through him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. It is the memra in the Aramaic Targums that is the juxtaposition of what John says in his gospel account. Can you see yet why we're spending time establishing this connection? So why did I read all these quotes to you? Because it's essential to know that these references to the word, the memra, show up in the Targums over and over and over again in order to understand the significance of what the Apostle John is saying in the opening statement of his gospel account. While it's true that the only copies of the Gospel of John that we have are written in Greek, it's not the language that we expect John to have written them in. Keep in mind, once again, John was a fisherman. He was considered to be uneducated. He likely knew some Greek, but it's highly unlikely that he was fluent in it. Certainly not fluent enough to write several books of the Bible in that language. So when John wrote his gospel account, although I cannot prove this, it's highly likely that the original copy was written in Aramaic and then was later translated into Greek, which end up being the copies that we have today. That being the case, I submit to you that when John penned the opening statements, he said, "In the beginning was the memra, and the memra was with Elohim, and the memra was Elohim." But because this epistle was translated into Greek, we have to, at least temporarily, look at it from a Greek perspective. So when we read in John chapter 1, verse 1, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with Elohim, and the Word was Elohim," the Greek word that is used three times in this verse is the word logos. It is the word logos that's used each time that we read the word word in this passage. The same word is used in verse 14. What is this word logos, and what does it mean? How is it used in Greek documents? Well, this word was first attributed to the Greek philosopher Heraclitus, who lived roughly about 500 years or so before Yeshua. That means he lived before the Maccabean Revolt. In fact, he lived around the time that Nehemiah was rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem. Heraclitus used this word, logos, to communicate a principle of order or knowledge. About 150 years later, Aristotle, one of the most famous of the Greek philosophers, described the word logos as a reference to reasonable discourse, or basically debate. One of the first century contemporaries of Yeshua was Philo. He was a Hellenistic Jewish philosopher who lived in Alexandria, Egypt. Philo attempted to find ways to harmonize the Torah with Greek philosophy. Philo was known to speak of two different types of logos. Philo made a distinction between what he called the logos prophorikos, which means the uttered or spoken word, and what he called the logos endiathetos, which means the word remaining within. So one of Yeshua's contemporaries, a respected Hebrew philosopher, used this term logos to refer to something that is akin to the Spirit giving us utterance. The point of all this is to show that within the Hellenistic world, the Greek world, within which the nation of Israel operated, this term logos was a well-known term that was used to describe a creative force within the universe that provokes us to speak. In modern language, we would refer to this concept as our conscience, something that is inherently within all mankind that prompts us to speak forth or to act in some way that is in line with our morals or principles. This explains why this word became known within early church history to be a term that identified the source or power through which all things were created, which, by the way, fits with the description of the memra, as we discussed moments ago, as well as the description in the first chapter of John. In fact, in the 4th century, when attempts were made to translate the Greek New Testament into Latin, this word was a source of frustration for the translators, because there was no adequate Latin word to describe the concept of the Greek term logos. Then, fast forwarding through history, by the time the Bible was translated into English, the translators said, forget the Latin, they went back to the Greek and relied upon some of the early Greek references as their justification for using the English word, word, to represent this concept, due to the link between speech and this concept of logos. Thus, in our modern English versions, it says, In the beginning was the Word. It's incredibly important for us to properly define these types of things. Why? Because the Greek word logos is used 330 times in the New Testament, and it's overwhelmingly used to communicate the concepts of words or speech. Unfortunately, contrary to this evidence, due to the conclusions we have come to in this walk of faith, we tend to make the mental assumption that the word that's being used here in John chapter 1 is the Greek word namas, not the Greek word logos. Why is that important to know? Because the Greek word namas is the word that is used 197 times in the New Testament, every time we read the word law. Now, the single Greek word namas is used every time that we read the word law in the New Testament, regardless of its context or whether or not it's a reference to the Torah. But that's another topic of conversation we'll cover in another series sometime in the near future. This distinction, however, is vital to know in order to combat the mindset that I mentioned that's found a way to permeate our walk of faith. It is not the Torah that was made flesh. It was not the Torah that was with Elohim and was Elohim. It was the Logos, the Word, the Memra from the Aramaic Targums that John would have been familiar with. By understanding that John was referencing the Memra, the Word from the Aramaic Targums, that it was this Memra that had become flesh, we can now make sense of his statements. When he said this, he was pointing directly to the word that was used to describe Adonai himself throughout the Targums, the translation of the Tanakh that was written in the language all the first century believers would have been familiar with. Outside of that context, we Westerners can easily make the mistakes that we have, without knowing that John is making a reference to something that is specific to the language he and all his contemporaries spoke. We then impute our own understanding into the context, rather than allowing the context to define our interpretation. This is how we end up making the assertion that somehow the Torah became flesh. It certainly did not. It wasn't the Torah that became flesh and dwelt among men. It was the one who gave the Torah to his people that became flesh. There's a huge difference between the two. Why is this such an important distinction to make, Daniel? Because I've heard over and over from people that Torah is Yeshua and Yeshua is Torah. Why? Due to the misunderstanding of these passages from the book of John. The big logical flaw that becomes a huge problem with this is that this mentality is the first step that leads down the path to rejecting Yeshua and converting to Judaism. And we'll look at that. After all, if Yeshua is the Torah, then what did I ever need Yeshua for? The Torah is enough. Let me be clear here. In no way, shape, fashion, or form is John attempting to make a statement in John chapter 1 that the Torah became flesh. He was saying that Adonai himself in the form of Yeshua became flesh. Yeshua is not equal to, nor is he the same as, the Torah. The Torah didn't die a bloody, gruesome, agonizing death on behalf of my sins in order to set me free. Yeshua did that. The Torah is wholly inadequate to absolve me in any way of my intentional sin. Now, Leviticus chapters 4 through 6 do tell me about how I can have my unintentional sin remedied. But nowhere in the Torah can I find anything that will absolve me from my intentional sin. Let's be honest here. 99% of the sin that you and I commit, it's intentional. It's not accidental. We consider it. We weigh it, we think about it, and then we go ahead and commit it, knowing that it's wrong. That's intentional sin. And there's no remedy for that type of sin anywhere in the Torah. Some might claim that intentional sin is dealt with on Yom HaKippurim. And indeed, you can look at the text and find the words in the Hebrew that talk about intentional sin. But can you tell me what individual is allowed to bring a sacrifice for sin on that day? Only the high priest. No one else. You and I would not be able to bring a sacrifice for our intentional sin on that day. Yom HaKippurim is a day that deals with the sin, both unintentional as well as intentional, for the nation of Israel, not for the individual. This is why mankind so desperately needs a savior. If not for Messiah, we would have no release, no freedom from our intentional sin. It would be over our heads forever with no hope of ever coming out from under it. The Torah provides no relief for this type of sin. The Torah only points out what my sin is. Only Messiah can deliver us from our sin. The Torah, to give you an analogy, is a stop sign. Yeshua is the judge. When I come to a stop sign, it requires that I stop. The stop sign is there to prevent me or someone else from being injured or killed. The Torah is kind of like that stop sign. I can choose to obey the stop sign and stop at the intersection, or I can choose to disregard it and fly right through that intersection. If I don't stop, however, there are consequences. One of two scenarios could unfold. First, I could get pulled over by an officer. That would be the preferable option of the two, because the second option, Lord forbid, someone else is approaching that same stop sign and expecting me to stop, but I blow right past it and I end up hitting them. This could end up leading to serious damage or even death. You see, the stop sign is there to prevent me from harming myself or others. The Torah operates exactly the same way. It's the stop sign that helps me to avoid hurting myself or others. But back to that stop sign. If I blow through it and an officer pulls me over, I'm going to end up going to court. Yeshua is not the stop sign. Yeshua is the judge. He's the one who has the power to set me free from my disregard for that law. The two are not the same. The Torah is not Yeshua, and Yeshua is not the Torah made flesh. If the Torah could solve all of our problems, why did Yeshua need to die on the cross? Further, if the Torah is equal to Messiah, why would we need Messiah at all? Let's just do a quick comparison here. Yeshua saves us. The Torah does not. Yeshua redeems us. The Torah does not. Yeshua atones for sins. The Torah does not. Yeshua is our great high priest. The Torah is not. Yeshua is far greater than the Torah. Now, before you turn off the TV and call this guy a heretic, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say that the Torah isn't important. The Torah is Adonai's expressed will for us to live by. It's the way he communicates his desires to us. But it's not him. The instructions that I give my children, they're not me. The instructions I give my children cannot wrap their arms around my children when they're in pain and bring them comfort. Now, it's true, there is a type of comfort that we receive from the Torah from the perspective that it defines the boundaries that keep us safe. But those instructions are not the same as the one who gave them. There is much more to say on this topic. But at this point, we've come to an end of our time for this episode. Please join us again for our next episode, where we will continue this discussion and examine why the mentality behind this misinterpretation of John chapter 1 is so dangerous. Until next time, shalom.